Senate Finance. It's 9:13 on February 23rd. Welcome, committee members. Co-chair Meyer, co-chair Chenault, vice chair Senator Bundy will be here in just a moment. A couple of Senator Dyson has a bill up. He'll join us in progress. I want to welcome on the Senate side Senator Hoffman, Senator Olson.
Morning. Morning,
guys. Senator Stedman, myself, co-chair Wilkins. Senator Green is traveling. And on the House side, Representative Chenault, would you mind?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the House side, we have Representative Kelly, Representative Holmes, Representative Stoltz. That's all I see in the room right now. And my co-chair over there, Representative Meyer, who was already introduced.
Purpose of...
Mr. Chairman.
Well orchestrated. Purpose of today's meeting is to have our annual update from folks associated with our permanent fund. And before we ask Chairman Brady to join us at the table, I'd like to ask if there's anything else come before the committee before we begin. Seeing none, then let's welcome to the table Mike, who's going to join us. I think Chairman Brady is going to begin, and I'll just turn it over to them and do as you wish. I know you're going to do some introductions, but welcome, sir. Nice to have you here.
And thank you,
We look
sir.
Forward to your presentation today.
Chairman and committee members, thank you again for affording us the time and opportunity to present our annual capital markets report. First, I'd like to introduce Vice Chair Steve Frank. Commissioner Corbis is not with us, nor is the Attorney General Marquez is here, and Eric Wolfert is with us as well. First, we'd like to say and address House Bill 215 and say thanks for the vote of confidence in passing that legislation last year, which gives us additional responsibility and enormous responsibility in our minds. But it was not just a compliment; it was a progress in how we go about doing our business. We appreciate that.
Mr. Brady, could I just, housekeeping for the record, could I ask you to introduce yourself?
I'm sorry. I'm Carl Brady, and I'm the chairman of the Board of Trustees of the corporation. Have been. This is the third year for me. I was first appointed by Governor Hickel and was chairman that tenure. I was fired by Governor Knowles and then reappointed by Governor Murkowski.
Thank you.
That's the way it goes.
And we're glad you're here, Carl.
Thank you. I am too. At this time, I'd like to introduce Mike Burns, who's the Chief Executive Officer of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation, to come forward.
Morning, Mike. Welcome to Senate Finance.
Morning, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
House Senate Finance today.
Trustee Hudson is here also.
I'm sorry. Excuse me.
I'm no stranger.
My favorite trustee, too. I apologize, Bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's nice to be with you this morning. For the record, Mike Burns, and I'm Chief Executive Officer of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. Just give you a couple of quick updates. You have some handouts, but I'll go through these pretty quickly. But for fiscal year 2005, our total fund return was 10.4%. The real rate of return after inflation was 7.7%. And the balance in the fund last June 30th was $29.96 billion. That was an increase from FY04 of almost $2.6 billion. There is a chart in there that has a bar chart that has the total return for the last 5 years that I think is pretty self-explanatory. And I'd just like to draw your attention to what we have done the first 6 months of this fiscal year through December 31st. Our total return for that 6 months has been 6.7%. On an annualized basis, that's 13.4. The first 6 months at 6.7 is no guarantee of another, but just for apples to apples, we did annualize that for you. The ending value of the fund December 31st was $32.2 billion. That's up $1.3 billion in the first 6 months. $2.3 billion. And I would note just between December 31st and yesterday, it's up about another $1.3 billion. So the wind is at our back. A question that comes up pretty regularly is, what is our realized income? Is what goes into the dividend formula? For the first 6 months, our realized income was $1.3 billion. That compares for all of fiscal 05 of $1.75 billion. So we're substantially ahead. And just if you're looking at the formula, the number that falls out of the formula is about $1.2 billion. And the number that goes in will be this year's, but as I said, for the first 6 months, we're higher than we were for the entire year that falls out of the formula. Couple of things. Chairman Brady talked about House Bill 215 and what a big step forward that is for the fund and for the state. Two major things, we've reported this to LBNA, but I would just go over quickly that with that new authority under 215, we have adopted a set of regulations for investments. Our staff worked with Callan, the board's advisors, outside managers, and legal counsel to come up with these new investment regulations. What we needed to do was to define the prudent investor rule and cover all the possible investments, including those that we're not even considering at this time. The investment regulations are fairly detailed, and probably the detail and the complexity is driven as much by not the asset classes themselves, but the new combinations. You can, as I think Mr. O'Leary says very often, you can be an owner or you can be a lender, and that's pretty much the basic classes of assets, whether it's there's so many strategies now that are combinations of being an owner or a lender. It's hard to list them all, so we didn't try to list them all, but we tried to cover all the potential opportunities that we thought we had. We also adopted a confidentiality regulation, which I think has been reported on at some length. And let me assure you that nothing in the confidentiality regulations that we've adopted changes anything. There has been a statute on the books since 1980, since the Permanent Fund Corporation was created, and it doesn't allow us to keep information of private parties confidential. It requires us to keep it confidential. We adopted a regulation to implement that statute. So let me assure you, there's nothing that is confidential today that was not confidential a year ago or 25 years ago. We thought it was more straightforward to have a regulation that clearly set forth how we would address these confidential information. Primarily, it revolves around three asset classes. The first, I think, is pretty self-explanatory. It's real estate. We can't negotiate and compete with others to buy real estate if our numbers are known to the competitors. As soon as a real estate transaction is done, it becomes completely transparent. It's on our website. It's completely available. The two areas that are difficult for us are in private equity and absolute return. There you're dealing with the intellectual property of these investment managers. And that's their stock and trade. That's what they have to sell. And it's very important for us in those asset classes. Probably 75 or 80% of the success in those asset classes is in the very top tier. So that's where we want to be. And they are, obviously, if they're top tier, they have the most intellectual property to protect. So they're very, very protective of that. And our statute requires us to honor that confidentiality. As a matter of fact, in the year and a half that I've been here, and as looking back, I don't see it in our history anyplace. We actually had someone who we were going to recommend to the board today as an absolute return manager called us on Monday and said they wished to be taken out of consideration because they didn't like our confidentiality regulations didn't go far enough for them. Now, I don't know if that's right or wrong, but that is the kind of marketplace we're dealing with for those two assets. So, leave you with one word. Nothing is confidential today that wasn't confidential a year ago or 25 years ago. So we've taken no steps. Now, I would like to introduce...
Mr. Burns, before we begin? Go to the next step. What is absolute return?
It's a hedge fund strategy. Actually, there's 14 strategies that we take care that we take part in. There's long, short. They're basically non-directional strategies for the most part, where you're long and short, and you live on the difference. We have used it. Let me go back and just say, when we talk about our equity markets, how our performance is, it's all relative to our peers and relative to our benchmarks. An absolute return is we hire someone to get a set return of so many basis points over LIBOR, and we want to keep them in a narrow band. It's more attractive for us than fixed income, has a little less volatility than fixed income, and we have been replacing some of our fixed income with it. But Mr. O'Leary, I think, can walk you through that also, but it's a family of strategies, and we have a one manager, Crestline, that is what we call a gatekeeper, and they put us into partnerships and move the money depending on what's most attractive.
I might add, Mike, the simplest way to view hedge funds is a long short, creating what we call market neutral. You might buy, for example, if you thought, you might buy long General Motors and short Ford on some different percentage and create a neutral. And the concept is a bond rate of return plus 200 or 300 basis points. It's risk is relatively low. Its upside isn't that great. But it's a vehicle that many, many, many institutions use. As a matter of fact, in this alternative class, universities, 40-50% of their investments are in this alternative class.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Stedman?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I'm wondering if they could, because there's a lot of people around the state watching us here, and maybe they could explain what the London Interbank transfer rate is, along with what is long a position and what is a short position, and what is market neutral, so people at home could follow the conversation.
And I would defer that to Mr. O'Leary. I think he could.
I think Mr. O'Leary could carry you through that. You know, we can get through it, but I think Mr. O'Leary is probably. You can maybe start with that.
Well, if he isn't going to do it, we'll ask him to do it.
Let's hold that question and let it dangle, and if Mr. O'Leary can pick it up.
And if he doesn't, we'll come back.
But you'll know somebody that will.
Yes,
he will.
Other questions or comments from the Permanent Fund? Thank you for being here. Let's welcome back. Mike, would you introduce Mr. O'Leary?
Good morning, all. It's a pleasure to be back. For the record, my name is Michael O'Leary. I'm an executive vice president with Callan Associates, Inc. We've had the good fortune of counting the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation as a client for over 15 years. And I've appeared before this committee or other committees here quite frequently during that span. I've always found it stimulating. Senator Stedman's question, I think, is a good one, because we all talk a language that many people don't understand. The London Interbank Offering Rate is a very short-term floating interest rate, really a day-to-day interest rate. And it is a standard for people borrowing and lending money on a very short-term basis. So it would be analogous to an overnight deposit rate in the United States. It is denominated in dollars for U.S. Investors, lenders, or borrowers. And so there's no currency risk, and it is essentially high-quality, riskless investment. And so a lot of floating rates are pegged to it, the London Interbank Rate plus or minus, plus some premium for risk. When we refer to long in the context of investments, what we mean is you own the security. So you own 100 shares of Microsoft, you're long 100. And short is refers to a position where you sell a security that you don't own and are obligated to deliver it to whoever purchased it. That's facilitated through securities lending. The broker that you use to sell the security short borrows the security from somebody and delivers it, so whoever bought it actually now is an owner of that security. And the short seller receives the proceeds, or their agent receives the proceeds, and is responsible for ultimately closing out the position by buying the security. So you short a security when you think it is going to decline in value, and if you're right, you make money when you close the position out by buying it at a lower price. In today's world, investment world, if you were long, and GM and Ford these days may be bad examples, if you were long Toyota and short GM, that would be presumably little in industry exposure, because they're both auto companies. And if the market went up, you'd expect your long position to go up, and maybe your short position, if you were correct in your judgment, would go up less. And so the focus of a long-short pair trade like that is that the relative prices are the source of the return. If you're right in your long decision and right in your short decision, you'll achieve an attractive return, regardless of which way the market goes. If the market goes up, it really doesn't matter, because you've negated much of the market exposure by being long and equally short. Is that, Senator Stedman, is that sufficient?
Correct. You make money when the stock goes up if you're long, and you lose, and you make money if the stock goes down if you're short.
Right. And if you have an equal weighting in both positions, you've taken out the general volatility of the market. And typically what you would hope to make in that type of totally matched trade would be something like 4 or 5% per year more than a short-term riskless investment.
Is the LIBOR to world banking as the federal funds rate is to American
yes.
banking?
Yes.
Same type of thing?
It's just a little bit more generally used.
Interesting. Okay.
Okay. I have a presentation, and I have been instructed and beaten severely about the head and told it shouldn't last longer than 20 minutes, so I will limit myself to that.
You've traveled a long ways. Our time is your time.
This is the presentation that I'll be referring to, and the pages are numbered. Every year, Callan develops looking ahead five-year projections, and they represent our best thinking about the relative appeal of stocks, bonds, and other forms of investment. And we change them at the pace of a glacier, because we're really making long-term forecasts. We're not saying this is what we expect the market to do this year. And I know that you all recall that doesn't represent a change in the way that we do things, but I do want to underscore it for those who are new to this type of presentation. We always expect stocks to return more than bonds and bonds to return more than cash, but we recognize that there may be five-year periods where stocks do more poorly than bonds, or bonds do more poorly than short-term investments. We account for that by forecasting a range of returns around that central midpoint long-term return. And the range of returns for ownership types of investments like equities is clearly much wider than the range of returns for bond, high-quality bond investments. And I'll give you specific numbers in a little bit. It's very important that the projections be consistent with one another. That is, if you think inflation is going to be X, you can't have a long-term expected return for a risky investment that is less than X. It doesn't work. And it is essential that you expect equity investments, which are riskier than fixed investments, to have the potential to generate a greater rate of return. Okay. If you go on to page three, number three, there are a couple of points. The way that we go about building the projections is to really spend a lot of time thinking about inflation and where longer-run inflation is going to be. And that really influences our judgment about what level of cash returns, short-term investment returns, one could reasonably expect. Over the very long term, cash returns have seldom been significantly, have seldom been significantly in excess of inflation. And generally, when they have been, it's because people have overestimated inflation. And conversely, short-term investments seldom produce a return that is less than inflation. We've been through one such period recently. Back a couple of years ago, when short-term interest rates were 1%, that was actually a negative real return, because inflation was higher than short-term money. We take the same approach toward thinking about fixed investments, and then we focus a lot of time on the relationship in expected return between stocks and bonds, fixed investments. We also think about large cap stocks versus small cap stocks, and domestic stocks versus international stocks. So that's the level that we're thinking about. If you go look on page four, you'll see the calendar period return for major asset classes over the last 6 years. And we included the 6 years to include the bear market. So the 6 years really begins with the beginning of the bear market. And so the first 3 years were really very poor returns, and the last 3 years have basically been recovery periods. On the right-hand side of the page, we show returns for different cumulative periods. And you can see it, by contrasting the five-year return numbers with the 10-year numbers, how various asset categories have performed. I call your attention to the Lehman, the LB aggregate, so the Lehman aggregate, a bond index. And over the 5 years that ended last December, that index returned 5.87%. Stocks returned only 1.58% using the Russell 3000 as a measure of the broad U.S. stock market, despite the fact that they've done very well recently. If you look over at the 10-year number, this is more typical, I think more reflective, of the longer-term relationships between stocks and bonds. And I put that out on the table here so that you have a context when we get to our projections about the future. Okay, I'm going to, page five is an outline of some of the points I want to hit, and if I don't, please raise questions. We begin by thinking about where are we in the economy, and on page six we start with the biggest sector of the economy, consumer spending. And here, there are legitimate reasons, I think, for concern. Consumer spending has really carried the economy, and because it's such a huge part of the economy, you always expect it to. But it's really done better than we probably had a right to expect. And in our view, and the view, I think, of most economists, the rate of increase in consumer spending has to decline. And I'll develop that a little bit. Savings are low. Indeed, some would say they're negative, the savings rate. The beneficial effect of tax cuts in terms of increasing disposable income are largely passed. Interest rates now are higher than they were, and that is very significant in terms of the impact on housing and people's ability to extract equity from housing. And obviously, energy costs are up substantially. Fortunately, throughout most of the nation, we've had a comparatively minor winter in terms of energy use. People have been able to miss much of that increase in energy costs. Ultimately, the consumer's ability to spend is a function of income, and income, of course, is a function of jobs. If you look on page 7, you see the pattern of employment, and employment growth has been strong. During the recovery, it was initially very slow, but then it has picked up, and the number of jobs created has been quite high. But as we look ahead, we need to continue to see employment growth in order to support consumer spending growth. Page 8 is an important page. It depicts the percent growth in consumption and the percent growth in disposable income. And for 3 years, 03, 04, and 05, those are basically actual numbers. And then 06 and 07 are projected, and the projections are from Global Insight. And what should jump out at you off the page is that consumption has been growing more rapidly than income.
Credit.
Yes. And Global Insight's projections going ahead are the reverse of that. So clearly the pace of, in order for that to happen, the pace of growth in spending has to diminish. If you go on to page 9, this is really an important page, and it was reproduced from a presentation made by the CEO of Alliance Bernstein at a, yes, sir?
I'm sorry. Representative Kelly?
Just a clarification question, Mr. Chairman. When you said that the, back on page 8, you know, what you showed is that the consumption was outpacing real growth in income, and then at the tail end, the 06 and 07, we see that's turned around. When you made the statement, just as you were tailing off there, that this was that, that Global expected that to flip over.
Global Insight was the source of this, right, of this projection.
I understand, but what, do you, what did you mean? Did you mean to continue the income, disposable income outpacing consumption, or was that going to flip again?
Oh, no, that this was their projection that we would flip from consuming more than income grew to the reverse.
Thank you. That's what I thought, but I wanted to make sure.
Thank you for the clarifying question. Back on page 9, the folks at Alliance Bernstein put these numbers together, and what they depict is the growth in mortgages in excess of new housing investment. So if you look at all the mortgages that were created in each of these calendar years, and for 05, it's just for 9 months of 05. What was the value of the mortgages relative to the value of the real estate, the new real estate investment? So the new real estate investment would not only be new houses, but it would be the price of existing houses that were sold to somebody, and the new buyer got a mortgage. And so $350 billion in 05, for 9 months in 05, of mortgages were issued in excess of the housing investment. So in effect, that is the amount of money that came out of housing into the consumers' pockets to use for other purposes. Now, if you take that as a percentage of consumer, of personal consumption expenditures, you can see that it accounted for a large amount of personal consumption expenditures. And if you think of that in terms of the impact on growth, basically what you're saying is, if that went away, if the consumer's ability to take money out of mortgages, out of their house, went away, they wouldn't be able to sustain that level of spending. And so when you think about what's happened in terms of interest rates rising, people will still be able to do this, but they just it won't be as easy to do. There won't be as many folks that will be able to do it.
So the chart on the left is the result of me refinancing my house.
Yes.
And taking the $50,000 and going and buying a boat. And that.
Well, the chart on the left doesn't say what you do with the money. It just says you refinance and you got $50,000 out.
And I didn't take. And I didn't earn that $50,000 at my job. I earned it just by flipping the mortgage and getting the value out of the house.
Right.
And the total of all of the people that did that is we pulled $350 billion out of personal equities in our
Your equity in your house.
Wow, that's extraordinary.
Turned it into debt.
Now, there's been a lot of appreciation in the value of homes too, so people may feel as if they still have the same equity in their house. It's just that the house is worth a heck of a lot more now.
Tim Schnell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. How does interest-only loans, do interest-only loans play into this also to an extent?
Interest-only loans, let's think about that. If I were a new homeowner and the only way I could afford the home was to get an interest-only loan, I would have net new investment in housing for the amount of the loan. So that wouldn't be a reduction. That would not show up in this.
Well, my only reason for that is because of the issue of expenditures if you only went with an interest-only loan, even though that may be the only
thing you can afford. Yep, that's a good point.
Then at some point in time, my thought is that there's probably some consumption money there that a guy could spend because he only had the interest-only loan.
Absolutely. You are correct. If that same individual had a traditional mortgage, that individual's spending on other stuff would be a heck of a lot less. So if you look on page 10, again, these are the same numbers and the same source from AllianceBernstein's estimates. New housing investment through that 9-month period was $650 billion. The increase in mortgage debt was a trillion, thousand billions. And so the equity extraction was the 350. So the purpose for walking you through that was to say this has been a real important source of growth in the economy, that we're not forecasting that it's going to go away, but it's certainly going to be less powerful, less beneficial looking ahead than it has been. So that's one of the reasons to think that the growth rate in consumer spending will slow. Taking Coles to Newcastle, talking about oil prices in Alaska, but this is an interesting graph on page 11. It shows the real price of oil denominated in $06. And again, to the extent that there's a forecast here, it's from Global Insight. And while the real price of oil has increased tremendously, it still is well below where it was in the 70s. From the consumer's perspective, it is a real source, a real reduction. The increase becomes a reduction in their ability to spend disposable income. Look at page 12. We show two measures of inflation. The CPI, all urban consumers. And for the year, that was about 3.4%. But core inflation has been at the 2.2% rate. Most economists and many in the financial area focus on the core inflation rate because it has less volatility and noise than the broader rate. The cynics will correctly note that, well, people have to pay for energy and they have higher interest rates and have to pay for that on their mortgages. But nonetheless, I'm just stating that where we and most others put most of our focus is on the core rate. Ultimately, the permanent changes in food and energy prices work their way through to the core rate.
Is core urban minus energy minus food?
Yes.
Essentially?
Yeah. Okay, then the third, that inflation picture, I should note, it constitutes a change. We went for 20 years with sort of ever-decreasing inflation from the beginning of the 80s through the end of the 90s. Then we've really been in what we think is sort of a sideways period for inflation. If there's a bias, maybe the bias is towards slightly higher. And part of the explanation for that is on page 13. Our current account deficit is expected, again from Global Insights, to be $900 billion. I mean, that's huge. And a substantial part of GDP.
Mr. O'Leary, What's driven that? Is it mostly energy?
Our economy has been stronger than many others in the world, and we have outsourced a lot of things globally, and so our import, our balance of trade has been poor. But this is a current account, so it reflects not only trade, but also the flows of money. We've had high deficits, and somebody's got to finance those deficits. Foreigners have been very willing to buy our obligations, and in part because our interest rates have been higher than interest rates in much of the rest of the world. So I don't hold me to the number, but I think for almost 2 years, foreign investments in U.S. Treasury debt have exceeded the issuance of U.S. Treasury debt.
And we've issued an extraordinary amount of yes. Treasury debt over the last 2 or 3 years, haven't we?
Yep.
Representative Stoltz.
I think I'm going to have to leave in a minute. I wanted to. What's the effect on this extraction of the housing market if interest rates jack up several more percent? And, you know, how does that extraction wash, you know, if that's if all that equity is eaten up in higher interest, and how does that affect the market?
It clearly, further increases in interest rates would tend to have a negative effect on new housing activity, and it would be more difficult for existing homeowners to refinance. They probably couldn't, so that would be that would have a negative impact on economic activity, and it might slow down a lot of related industries, because when you think about anybody who moves into a new house, there are a lot of associated expenses that tend to follow from that, furniture, appliances, et cetera. So it certainly wouldn't be a plus. It would be a negative for economic activity.
Mr. Chairman.
And we do think, I recognize that you said you have to run out the door, but more of the interest rate hikes or increases we think are behind us than ahead of us. We think that we're really close to a plateauing of interest rates.
Senator Bundy.
Thank you, Mr. Kelly. Appreciate you being here. This may be a little stretch for you, but it's an underlying concern that goes around this building perhaps on an hourly basis, and that is we're looking at embarking on probably the largest construction project the world has ever seen, at least in cost. And perhaps you have said that interest rates are flattening out now, but I'm just wondering if you would care to speculate on financial conditions and the relationship to a potential $20 billion gas line?
The economy is undoubtedly, collectively, happy to see it as a source of reliable supply of energy. And it also, if you think about what are going to be the drivers of economic growth, fixed investment, business fixed investment, capital investment, is an important source of growth for the economy. So in a macro sense, I think most would perceive it positively. Now, that doesn't address your concern. Is it a good idea to do it? And I don't have any of the specifics. I've been up here long enough to think that it is, I'm delighted that it's proceeding, but I don't know, the devil's in the details, and I don't have any of the details.
Mike, Mr. Chair. Yeah, the thrust of my question was, does your economic projection encourage make the construction easier or more difficult. We're going to do it. It's a matter of is it going to cost more or less? So it's going to be more difficult.
Yeah, we're pretty optimistic regarding inflation being reasonably stable. And we're not forecasting a recession. So in the nearer term, that is the next 2 to 5 years or so, it would seem to be a reasonable environment in which to embark on such an undertaking.
Thank you very much.
Speaking of inflation, if you look on page 14, you'll see the record from the 60s and 70s, so ever-escalating inflation, including the oil price shocks of the 70s, then the 20 years of decelerating inflation, and thus far in the in 2000 subsequent period, it's been reasonably stable. And that we have moved up our five-year inflation forecast a little bit to 275 from 260, but that would still be in that sideways band. Page 15, the graph at the upper left shows the total return on a calendar year basis for the Lehman Bond Index. And the total return, of course, is comprised of how much income did you get and what sort of market price change occurred during a year. And so the income component is reflected in the upper right, and then the price change component is the lower left. And what should be apparent to you if you look in the upper right is that the income component has been diminishing as the general level of interest rates has declined. And some of the extreme volatility in price has also declined, looking at the lower left. I'm going to skip over page 16 and just focus on page 17. This reflects the yield to worst on the Lehman Aggregate Bond Index from January 01 through the end. There's a typo there. It should be the end of 05. And it ended 05 at 5.08%. And the way we build our forecast is we say, well, what do investors collectively think? And when you look at the bond market, the current yield on the bond market is a very good forecaster of the next five-year total return for the bond market. So our expectation is that investment-grade bonds will return approximately 5% over the next 5 years. If you go on to the next page, page 18, it's a histogram of the calendar year returns for the S&P 500. And we put the calendar year in a column that reflects what the return was during that year. Over the really long term, stocks have returned in nominal terms 10-11%, depending on how you define long-term return. But there's clearly been a great deal of volatility. And you can see several of the recent years right at the top. 05 was in that 0 to just under 10% range. 04 was in the 10 to 20% range. 03 was in the 20 to almost 30% range. So I included this to remind everybody about how volatile the return can be on a year-to-year basis. Fortunately, there are many more positives than there are negatives. And the negatives, if you go back to the real extreme negatives, 31, 37, 30, but then 1974 and 2002. Okay. You go ahead to page 19. This is a graph of the long-run average price-earnings ratio for the stock market. And this is based on reported earnings, not projected earnings. And you can see that by the end of 05, PEs were pretty close to the long-run average, way down from where they were before the bubble burst. And this has been a real feature of this economic recovery. Profit growth has been tremendous. So while the stock market has gone up, profits have actually gone up faster. So stocks on traditional valuation measures don't appear terribly richly priced. You go on to the following page. I know I've shown this graph before. It always is a little difficult to understand. It sort of it reflects the so-called Fed model, which is looking at the valuation level of equities relative to the yield on 10-year treasuries. And through most of the 80s and 90s, this was a pretty good, a pretty useful tool in determining where relative value was, whether stocks looked attractive relative to bonds or the reverse. Using this as one measure, and it is that only one measure of the attractiveness of stocks or bonds, stocks look relatively attractive versus bonds. Okay, if you go on to page 21, this summarizes our projections, which are essentially unchanged. The bottom line is that they are essentially unchanged from our five-year projections made a year ago, even though we're looking at a different five-year period now. We nudge the inflation number up to 275. That's a 15 basis point increase from last year. We moved up the expected short-term cash returns because of the increase in interest rates. Bond returns, I said, we set at 5%. And the equity returns for domestic equities in aggregate, so the broad, the Russell 3000 measure of the stock market, we left unchanged at 9%. Remember last year, the U.S. stock market was up just under 7% in total. Real estate, we held the expected return at 7.6%. And private equity, we held at 12%. International stocks did significantly better than domestic stocks last year, so we slightly narrowed the expected return for international stocks relative to U.S. stocks. From 9.25 was our five-year projection a year ago to 9.20, just to indicate, to recognize the pronounced outperformance of international stocks. All the numbers are spelled out on page 22, and we included the 05 projections. And I'd call your attention to the projected standard deviation column. That is a measure of risk, the volatility of returns, and you can see something like emerging markets are very, very volatile, and our projection is over almost 33% volatility. So that's basically twice what U.S. stocks are. So when you're building a portfolio, you not only have to put in what you think is an expected return for an asset category, but also what's the volatility of the asset category. And then finally, on page 23, using our projections of expected return, risk, and correlation, we develop an efficient frontier and compare our clients' policies to that efficient frontier. And so mixes 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 simply reflect possible mixes is an infinite number, but given our inputs, if you were pursuing a low-risk strategy, you might expect a 6.5% return, and at the other end of the spectrum, a really swing-for-the-fences type of strategy, mix 5 would be consistent with targeting an expected return of 8.5, but you'd see that that's almost entirely equity, comprised of equity. The permanent funds policy, which was adopted in November of last year and reflects the use of the increased flexibility that you have provided, made available to them, has an expected return of 7.77, which is consistent with a targeted real return of about 5%, given our assumptions.
Thank you, Mr. O'Leary. Questions? Senator Hoffman.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question goes to the fact that we've seen corrections in the markets in the early 90s, and as you have pointed out in your housing presentation, do you believe that there is a housing bubble in the United States? Will it be corrected?
There are clearly areas where there has been too much building and the building was in response to really extraordinary increases in price. And in those areas, it could be painful for the people that were doing the building. We don't see a bubble that needs to be burst. We think that the rate of increase in prices will really diminish, is already diminishing, and that houses will take longer to sell. But when we look at measures of affordability, while housing is less affordable today than it was 2 or 3 years ago, it is still comparatively affordable because interest rates haven't really shot up. The yield curve is flattened. Most of the increase in interest rates has been at the short end. So people who were dependent on ARMs to be able to afford housing are the people that are basically sort of squeezed out of that market. We may be wrong, but that's our view.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Stebbins.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, if I could, I got a couple of kind of two series of questions, and the first one's a short one. There's been a policy change at the board that redirected some of the assets into classes that are illiquid, and the way our dividend is calculated, it takes realized returns to help pump up the dividend, which is a concern to the residents of Alaska. And without going down the path of the overall obligation of the permanent fund to crank out dividends or grow, but it seems like there is a definite strategy difference between the way the permanent fund is heading in its management style than historically. And to put it in more technical terms, it looks like there's like a response from someone. It looks like it's being managed more on a percent of market value approach versus an approach that would realize potentially substantially more income to crank out dividends, and I'm just kind of curious about that.
Yeah. If I might, I'll take a whack at it. I know Mike would. I know in over the 15 years of working with the fund, the fund, from my perspective, has always focused on total return. Given the statutory limitations that have existed, that restricted the number of options of approaches that could have been used. Personally, I don't think that there is a significant change. There may be some minor change at the margin in the likely effect on realized income because of those shifts, and let me explain why. In the absolute return area, the turnover rates associated with the strategies tend to be pretty high, and so that results in quicker realization of gains or losses. The board has adopted, has incorporated high yield fixed investments as part of an expanded opportunity set for the bond area that also is a high income generator. Clearly, real estate is the major illiquid asset category, and that has that's been a fixture at the fund for some time, and we've always looked at the primary driver there being income return for the direct investments, but there is a meaningful portion of the real estate allocation that is invested in REITs, which are actively managed, so there is both income and realized gains or losses affecting realized income. So maybe private equity is the one place that if you had an income orientation, you certainly wouldn't invest in, because the long-term return, it is inherently long-term and capital gains type of strategy. But on average, I would guess it's a 6 to 8 year holding period for typical private equity fund, and then the gains are in effect distributed. So, and that's a targeted at a 4% allocation. The actual amount invested is significantly less than that. We haven't suggested, although the board might at some point, increase the overall equity allocation. That would probably have more of an impact, but that wasn't done, at least to date. Mike, did you want to?
Yes, sir. Mr. Chair, Senator Stedman, the statutes do not direct us at all towards investing, you know, with an eye on realized income. I mean, I don't have the exact verbiage in front of me, but they really talk to the total return, the maximum prudent return is what the trustees are required by statute to invest in. If the markets present us with the best maximum return in things that don't have current realized income, they still have to go with what the maximum return is within, you know, the prudent investor rule, because that's what the statutes say. If the distribution formula doesn't match up with that, we still have to go. You know, they're not responsible for the distribution formula. So if there is a disconnect, and I don't think there is particularly or meaningfully, but you know, we have a statutory guideline that we're required to do it.
Senator, if I could switch gears, that was an indirect, I guess, plug for percent of market value. But anyway, if I can go on to the next question on page 23, Mr. Chairman, there's an asset class mix with some targeted rates of return, and we deal with it not only as the informational from the permanent fund, but we also deal with it within our retirement system. I'm noticing here, Mr. Chairman, on mix number 5, for a targeted return of 8.5%, there's a 74% allocation to equities, if you count private equity on up. And then down at 8%, it's a 63% return, 63% rating at an 8%. And then they're targeted, the permanent fund's target is 7.77, and that's, I think, what it was a year ago when we sat here.
Closer to 760.
OK. Okay, 760. Okay, so that was close. At 57% equity exposure. So, you know, looking at this and looking at your allocation, you know, at a targeted rate of 7.7, and I assume that's from, Mr. Chairman, from 06 to 010, and then there's some time in the future. How does that asset mix play into the projections that are on the website for the public to look at? Is it the 7.7% number that's run out into the future, or is there some break after 2010 to a different growth rate?
Chris Phillips isn't here, is she?
Yeah. We use the 5-year rate for the whole period. So the 7.7 would be used for the whole 15-year projection.
Okay.
We don't change it after 5 years because we don't have any number.
I think the point of the question, Mr. Chairman, is for a future presentation when we sit down with the ARMS board and look at how they're managing your assets. Last year, if I remember correctly, there was some discussion in the relative similarity to the asset allocation within the retirement system and the permanent fund and the different goals and objectives of each and the different rates of return targets. And there was some concern with the 8.25% target that the pension system was using versus the 7.
Yeah. That's an excellent point, Senator Steadman. For the ARM board, for the pension programs, there is an expected growth in liabilities, which is importantly influenced by expected inflation. And the actuaries typically use estimates of inflation that are very reasonable from a very long-term perspective. I want to say 3.5, maybe 3.75%. And obviously the financial markets are dealing with where is inflation today. And so inflation today is lower than that. And that's reflected in cash markets, and it's reflected in fixed income investments. So these projections were developed using 2.75% expected inflation. If you said, well, let's develop a 40-year forecast, we would undoubtedly have a higher inflation number than 2.75. And what that would result in would be a higher expected return for stocks and bonds reflecting that higher inflation rate. So if I recall correctly, I think that the retirement board's expected return, the actuarial discount rate is 8.25%, and the expected return from their existing portfolio using the same sorts of assumptions and their policy mix is just under 7.9. And the big difference is they have a heavier commitment to private equity, and also have been able to do more in the absolute return area than the permanent fund had been able to do.
Can I ask one follow-up? I'm just kind of curious on the, I know if we look at, like was mentioned earlier, Ford and General Motors and Toyota, they're actively traded. Anybody can look on the exchanges around the world virtually 24 hours and figure out what they're worth. Some of the other assets that are possibly private equity or some other things aren't actively traded, and there's estimates used in calculating their rate of return.
Yeah.
Until such times they're liquidated, then you know what you made. Is it when you shift to those asset classes that are less actively traded, particularly if there's no liquidation for 4 years or 5 years or sometimes substantially longer than months, isn't the variability of potential outcomes spread?
Yeah, as our assumptions show, we use a very high risk number for investments where you don't even observe the volatility. and I'll use real estate as a good illustration. We use a standard deviation, a volatility estimate for real estate of 16.5%. We've used it for years. But when you observe real estate volatility, it looks like it's less volatile than bonds because of the appraisal process. In the private equity arena, the industry convention is to carry investments on a cost basis until there's some financing event that gives that would give you a basis for increasing the value. And that's not the universal approach, but that is what the majority of the partnerships do. And so actually there that creates the so-called J curve, where because you're paying fees, initially the return looks like it's negative, or is in fact negative, but to the extent that the investments are productive, you get it when they're liquidated. Just as with real estate, you don't really realize the gain until the property is ultimately disposed or refinanced or something. So our position is that private equity is inherently risky, but also has very attractive return opportunities. And so a comparatively small component of the portfolio, in the permanent funds case, the target is 4%, is entirely appropriate. And as we look at other endowments and foundations, as Chairman Brady pointed out, it is not uncommon these days to see upwards of 50% of their investment pools invested in a combination of private equity, let's say up to 15%, and then alternative strategies, including hedge fund strategies, of another 30%+.
If I could, Mr. Chairman, I think it's a point of discussion. It's a little bit off track, and I apologize for that, but there is a lot of interrelationships between the whole pension portfolio and the way it's managed in the permanent fund. They're both very critical to all the citizens of the state. And I just thought I'd bring up those couple of points, and maybe we can come back to this line of questioning with the ARMS board sometime in the future and the differences between those, because clearly the more volatility in the estimate of the portfolio, the more or the harder it is to get our arms around the potential exposure we have in the retirement system, because quite frankly it's already hard enough to get our arms around the liability side. Yeah. And it just potentially may widen the potential probable outcomes is all. And but I think we could take that up at another time.
Yeah, I'm sure we're going to talk a lot about that come next January. Senator Hoffman and then Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Probably to Mr. Burns, I've had some questions from constituents after the governor had said that he wanted to invest in the gas line, 20% in the gas line, and in the budget he has, and that would be, depending on the cost, $20 to $25 billion, $4 to $5 billion on the state's part, and the governor has put in the budget, a down payment on that in his presentation to the legislature, $400 million, and there's been some discussion, I guess, of the possibility of the permanent fund investing in the in that line as well, and I was wondering if the if the board has discussed that and what are the probabilities of that happening?
Through the chair, Senator, we have not been presented with any specific proposal that we would put this much in or be an equity owner or a debt holder or any of that. We have been put on notice or have been advised that we are under discussion in a lot of scenarios. This afternoon, actually, at lunch, our working lunch, we're going to discuss with the board the RFP that we have talked about and have brought forward to for funding. that would allow us to hire a financial advisor to look into basically, and these are really broad areas, but three areas for us. One would be the education of the board on capital infrastructure products or investment products. How are they being utilized in funds across the country? And you know, how might this fit into our portfolio? Second is, and this would be the second step when we're actually presented with something, if in fact we are, is it a good investment? What are the investment merits of an investment in the pipeline? And the third step would be, if it is a good investment, how does it fit into our portfolio? How does it complement that? So we are starting the process of hiring an expert, an independent expert, to lead us through that. And
and I guess the follow-up question is, do you believe that the board has the authority, depending upon what comes out of the research that will be done, for the board to make that decision in and of itself, or do you envision that that would require, in your opinion, approval of the legislature for that investment?
Well, through the chair, Senator, I don't have the full answer. I think it's going to be, at least the start, a very much an up or down question, the same that you and the legislature are going to be, you know, given. You're going to be asked, you're going to be presented with a deal, and my understanding of the way the process works, it's up or down. Our first cut absolutely has to be, is this prudent or is it not prudent? If it's not prudent, you know, then we can't go forward. And the two parts of the prudent, again, are, is it a good investment, and is it a good investment for this portfolio? And those both have to be answered. So it's that prudent, not prudent.
So the question on whether or not this, you would seek approval of the legislature or not, you say no to that?
No, I didn't. No, sir. You know, we're before this committee right now requesting an appropriation for that study. So I think, you know, whether it goes on the fast track or a supplemental, you control our budget, and those numbers are there. So I think significant input minimally would be significant. And I don't know what the other end of it is.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. O'Leary, thanks for coming up and giving us your detailed presentation. The question that I have has to do, obviously, with the permanent fund dividend that's held near and dear to everybody's heart. And it's the assumption, or maybe the misconception, that high oil prices has the effect of having a bigger permanent fund dividend. But as you look at your presentation here and looking at some of the numbers, I guess in an effort to try and get a succinct answer out of you, and you, as you look at the dynamics between high oil prices and low energy costs that affect the marketplace, what does, in the end, give us the bigger dividend? Indeed, high oil prices or low energy prices to have its ultimate return on the market?
Given the current approach to the dividend, the answer is the health of the financial markets.
So you're saying the low energy prices?
Well, not disruptive energy prices.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Other questions from the committee? Mr. Burns?
I just like to make you aware of something that we've been going through, and actually had the report yesterday. I don't know how many times in the last hour the word inflation has been mentioned. It's absolutely critical to an undertaking like this. In November, the board commissioned a study, an independent study, of the effects of inflation on our fund, and we got two reports yesterday, spent most of yesterday afternoon on this, which is basically we got the historical view of inflation, the economics of inflation, what the causes are, what the effects of it are, and then the effect on our portfolio going forward. What would be the damage of different, or what was the potential damage at various levels of inflation? And I don't want to get into it. I'd be glad to share that with you at any time. I think it's not appropriate now, but I think the first cut is that the fund is fairly well protected against anything but just a really extraordinary jump in inflation. I guess it's like flood insurance. You know, are you in the floodplain? Do you insure against the 100-year high water mark or the 25-year high water mark? And there are things we could do to give up yield, current yield, to protect ourselves in the future against inflation. And the trade-offs weren't very compelling at this point. So I don't want to say inflation's not a problem for us or an issue or a challenge, but we spent quite a bit of time just with this study and then yesterday, and I think we're pretty well poised.
That's very interesting.
Senator Seven.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. We're sitting here in quite extraordinary times, not only dealing with the oil and gas issue, but also with the effects of our permanent fund at $32 billion and growing, and the dividends. And I was wondering if we couldn't have the presenters talk a little bit about the expectations of the state dividend over the next 2 or 3 years relative to the last 2 or 3.
Mr. Chair, Senator, when I talked about the realized income, we have already realized in the first 6 months, I think it was about $1.3 billion, which is more than the number that falls out of the formula. So we've got another 6 months of realized income. At an absolute minimum, I think we get $60 to $70 million a month just in interest income and dividend income. So the number that's going into the formula is going to be significantly higher. On that chart, I think we'll probably be in the 75th percentile. We're thinking that right now, which will be a significantly larger number than drops out of that. And if you look at the next 2 years, the numbers in the formula, one's about $280 million, I believe, and one's $300 million or thereabouts. Very, very low numbers. So the dividend absent, you know, we knock on wood what happens between now and the balance of the year. The number will go up this fall, and the next two falls, it's going to really go up. So,
If the markets do,
yeah. But I mean, there are just extraordinarily low numbers falling out in 07 and 08.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, if you'll indulge me, I want to, the percent of, a percent of market value approach toward distributions really results in greater consistency and predictability. And I know that there's been support for that notion, and I just would be derelict in my duty if I didn't state that here.
Other questions of Mr. O'Leary or Mr. Burns? Representative Shaw, anything from you?
Nothing from me, Mr. Chair.
Mr. O'Leary, I just, on behalf of the House folks, had to go to the floor, and I appreciate Mr. Representative Chenault staying with us. But on behalf of the Senate Finance and House Finance, it's always a pleasure to have you join us. Your smiling face and your ability to dumb down this information so that we can understand it is always appreciated. And it reminds me, when you come every year, just how good we have it. And this is the only finance table in the nation that sits and talks about the kind of things that we're talking about. And so we should sit back and rub our belly because we got it pretty good. And with that, I would like to also say to Chairman Brady, Senator Frank, Mr. Wolforth, Representative Hudson, thank you for your leadership and your service in this very important board that we have in our state, unique to our state. We appreciate your guidance, and of course, Attorney General Marquez is there to help, but you folks drive it, and we appreciate that, and thank you for your service to the people of Alaska. If there's nothing else come before the committee, seeing none, then we stand adjourned. Thank you very much.
Thank you.